the views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
We have made a start. 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting from 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good morning, everybody. This is Good Morning Pacific Time Zone. I'm your host of the Space Show, David Livingston, for our Friday program. Thank you for tuning in. I'm going to quickly go through whatever announcements we have. I want to spend much more time with our guest today, Professor Avi Loeb, as he has to break a little bit early with us today. We're glad that he's going to be with us for about 70 minutes, something on that order. So if you do want to talk with the professor, you need to give us a call and not wait till the end of the show, 1-866-687-7223. And, of course, you can email us at drspace@thespaceshow.com. And a couple of other quick announcements. Sunday is open lines and anything goes, so please give us a call. And then I want to remind everybody that we're in our annual fundraising drive to fund the Space Show for 2023. And we're listener supported, so that means we definitely need your help and your assistance. And there's a big PayPal button on the upper right of our homepage. That's an easy way to support us. You can also use Zelle, Z-E-L-L-E, with your bank if your bank participates with Zelle. And the email address for Zelle is david@onegiantleapfoundation.org. That is our nonprofit company, as you know. And then you can also send a check made payable to One Giant Leap Foundation, and the mailing address in Las Vegas is on the PayPal button. And if you have any questions about any of this, please do let me know. And you can also consider sponsorships and billboard advertising. And if you're interested in that, you want to email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. But listeners, we are listener supported, so your support for 2023 is really, really important. And we hope that you will take advantage of that. As I said, our guest today is Dr. Avi Loeb, and he's at the Harvard University. He's been a guest many, many times, and his bio is on the website. I read an article not too long ago, just actually a couple of days ago, that Avi has some new and different ideas on the Big Bang Theory. And since we have discussed that quite a bit in recent years on the Space Show, I asked him back to talk about that, but we can talk to him about Galileo, and there's a lot of other things that are exciting and going on as we end 2022. Professor, welcome back to the Space Show. What's going on with the Big Bang Theory? Why do you think it may not be correct?
Well, we know that the universe is expanding, and as we go back in time, it was extremely dense and hot, and there is a point in time when it had an infinite density. That's called the Big Bang, and we call it also a singularity because that's a point in time when the equations of space-time that were formulated by Albert Einstein about 107 years ago break down. The equations cannot describe what happened around that time or before that time. And the reason is simple. Einstein's equations do not incorporate quantum mechanics, which is a very fundamental facet of very high temperatures, very high densities. And we don't have a theory that unifies quantum mechanics and gravity, so we don't know what happened before the Big Bang or just around that time. And there was a very popular model that was conceived about 32 years ago at the early 90s.
Hello? Did I lose him?
An early period when the universe not just expanded, but accelerated its expansion. That happens when the vacuum dominates the mass budget, and you end up with accelerated expansion where two points are being separated from each other at a speed that eventually exceeds the speed of light. And it's a consequence of Einstein's equations, and it allows to explain some of the properties of the observed universe. We know that if we look in one direction and then in the opposite direction, we find the cosmic microwave background, the radiation left from the Big Bang, to be exactly the same temperature. And there wasn't enough time for these two sides to communicate because the light that arrives to us just made it halfway to the opposite side. So there was no way that the two sides communicated with each other, except if there was some early time of accelerated expansion. In that case, these two points were in contact to start with, but then they were separated apart. And so that was an interesting way of explaining why the universe as we observe it is roughly uniform. But this theory of cosmic inflation faces a lot of challenges because once it was explored further, it basically allowed anything to happen. And in the words of one of the pioneers who invented the model of inflation, Alan Guth, everything that can happen will happen an infinite number of times in this model of eternal inflation, because what you have is different regions of space are going through inflation in different ways, and quantum mechanical fluctuations allow all outcomes to be realized an infinite number of times. So then the model is not really predictive. It cannot be falsified. And so it's not as satisfactory as initially thought. And there is a fundamental question of what happened early on in the universe and what triggered the Big Bang, what was before that time. And we don't know, and one alternative is perhaps the universe was contracting before it expanded, so it basically bounced, it contracted and then bounced back, and we just see now the expansion phase. Perhaps it's going through cycles where it's contracting and expanding and contracting and expanding. Another possibility that I actually thought about is, you know, once we have a theory that unifies quantum mechanics and gravity, we might be able to engineer it. We might be able to produce the conditions that in the laboratory that would lead to the creation of a baby universe, because we would know how to make a machine that creates a baby universe in the lab. And in that case, there is an interesting possibility that our universe was created in the lab of an advanced civilization that realized how to make a universe like ours. And it's sort of like generations of people that have babies that later on become adults and make babies and so forth. And if we are able to create a universe that can allow for new civilizations to emerge in it so that they would create baby universes, then you end up with this infinite progression of you know, civilizations that give birth to new universes, that give birth to new universes through the civilizations inside of them. So that's an interesting possibility that maybe there was some scientist in a white coat that was responsible for our existence through a baby universe.
Is this a concept or idea, or are these ideas gaining acceptance in the, I guess I'll say, the peer-reviewed type of community, or is there resistance to this kind of thinking?
Well, the fundamental aspect of science is that an idea has to be testable, that you can in principle falsify it. And one of the problems with cosmic inflation is that it's quite difficult to prove it wrong, because any outcome is possible within the current incarnation of the theory. In principle, you can reverse engineer any outcome that is observed in the universe, any observable. You can then find a model of inflation that would accommodate it. And that makes the theory not falsifiable, because you can't prove it wrong. So I was quite frustrated with that aspect of cosmic inflation. And just a month ago, we published a paper with a postdoc, Sani Vagnozzi, that we identified actually a way out of this conundrum, and we found a way of falsifying inflation. And the idea is quite simple. Very early on, the universe was extremely hot and dense, and there was a background of radiation of gravitational waves produced at that time. And that is thought to have happened before cosmic inflation. Now, if the universe went through cosmic inflation, this background of gravitational waves would have been diluted. But if there was no cosmic inflation, then it wouldn't have been diluted. There was no vast expansion. And so we can aim to detect experimentally that the cosmic radiation background of gravitation waves or gravitons, in the same way that we detected the cosmic microwave background, which is a background of photons left over from the Big Bang. Or there is also an expected background of neutrinos left over from the hot Big Bang. So if we do detect experimentally the graviton background, that would rule out the possibility that there was an expansion phase like cosmic inflation. So we suggested that, and it's in principle possible in a laboratory to produce a strong enough magnetic field such that you would end up converting the graviton background into an electromagnetic signal. So that was our paper just from a month ago, and I hope that the people will follow on that as an experimental way of testing cosmic inflation, because at the moment there is no other way of ruling it out. So that's with respect to cosmic inflation. Now, with respect to the idea that I mentioned about our universe coming out of an earlier phase of a laboratory of an advanced civilization, you know, that would be more difficult to test. One possibility is if we, find evidence that it's possible to make baby universes. So if we develop a theory of quantum gravity that allows us to imagine engineering laboratory conditions that enable to do that, that would at least open up the possibility that our universe was created this way. So it's sort of like figuring out that it's possible to give birth to babies. You know, then once you realize how to make babies, then you say, okay, well, we might have arrived here because we had parents. So that's one way to do that. Now, I'm a strong believer that the progress in science is made only by experimental tests. So in my view, there is no point in, discussing how many likes an idea gets within peers or within in social media. That's not really the relevant way of judging whether an idea has merit. So hopefully in the future we'll make progress on both testing cosmic inflation or testing the idea that I just mentioned.
So for a baby universe, from our perspective, we can't even contemplate the size of our universe. I mean, you know, it's beyond what most of us can contemplate. It's so huge. And that would be a baby universe?
It's huge right now, but it started very small. So the universe is expanding. In Einstein's theory of gravity or space-time, space-time is dynamic, it's changing. So just to give you an example, if you have ants sitting on the stationary, not moving at all, on the surface of a balloon, and you inflate the balloon, the ants would be separated from each other without even moving. And in principle, if you blow the balloon very rapidly, then the ants would be separated faster than they can walk. And you can think of this as an analogy to the expansion of space. If you have two observers that are not moving at all, just the expansion of space separates them. And if space expands very rapidly, as is the case during cosmic inflation when the vacuum dominates the mass budget, or as is happening right now, actually, turns out the vacuum is dominating the mass budget today for us. And the universe is accelerating right now. There was a Nobel Prize in Physics awarded for that discovery. So in the future, you know, we would be separated from all other galaxies faster than light. And we would be basically left on our own in a vast void of space, dark, and with only the ability to see our own galaxy. And that's it. And this will happen once the universe will age by another factor of 10 in our future. So here is a very specific circumstance where we know that the current conditions in the universe would lead us to be isolated. And the future, I actually wrote a paper about it 2 decades ago, saying that the future, the long-term future of extragalactic astronomy is quite gloomy. I mean, we will not be able to see anyone except for our own galaxy, and therefore, you know, we better look out when we can in the coming billions of years.
If the balloon keeps expanding, it'll eventually burst. Does the universe, if it keeps expanding, burst, or it just keeps on going?
Yeah, well, in the case of a balloon, there is surface tension, you know, the rubber that makes up the surface. The more you blow the balloon, the more tension there is.
Correct.
The amount of mass on the surface that the rubber contains is limited. And as a result, when the area of the balloon becomes too large, that creates too much tension and the balloon bursts. But in the case of expansion of space, there is no such tension. The space can expand forever to arbitrary dimensions. And in principle, the expansion could stop at some point. For example, if the vacuum itself decays. So as of now, the vacuum has some mass density, mass per unit volume, or energy per unit volume. And if for some reason that energy per unit volume decays into particles, which is the case for cosmic inflation, that's exactly what was imagine that there was an early phase when the vacuum dominated, and then it decayed, so inflation stopped. So in principle, today we have sort of the beginning of another inflationary phase, an accelerated phase. And if the vacuum would decay, then the accelerated expansion would stop. And in principle, you know, you could imagine a situation where our universe even would start contracting, but all of that depends on a large uncertainty as to whether the vacuum is stable or not. If the vacuum is stable, this expansion will continue forever, and we will be left in a dark void without any other galaxies visible to us.
You have a caller. Let's see what your caller would like to talk to you about. Good morning, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you? And go for it.
Hi, David and Navi. This is John in Fremont, California.
Okay.
And, Avi, the cosmic graviton background, you talk in your paper about detectors that we could build to assess this cosmic graviton background. Can the LIGO gravitational observatory be used for that, or you need some other sort of detector?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. So gravitational waves are just like electromagnetic waves. They come with different wavelengths. In the case of electromagnetic waves, that's the origin of the rainbow, the fact that, you know, you see different colors depending on the wavelength of light. And just to give an example, you know, when we look at the sky during the day, they appear blue. When the Orion spacecraft took an image of the Earth from behind the moon, the Earth appeared as a blue marble. Why do we see this blue marble? It's simply because the scattering of blue light is much more prominent. It's called Rayleigh scattering in physics, and it's just much more efficient. The atoms of air scatter blue light much more effectively than red light, and as a result, you see the Earth as blue because of the scattered sunlight. And by the way, that's the same reason that when you look at the sunset, it appears red, because what happens is the blue light gets scattered when the sun is just over the horizon, and there is a larger column of air along the line of sight. So the blue light gets scattered, and only the red light penetrates through, and then you see the sunrise is very red. And I joke every morning, and just yesterday it was amazingly red, the sunrise. I joke at 5 a.m., and so it's an illustration of Rayleigh scattering, and it explains also why the Earth appears blue. So light, electromagnetic radiation, does have many different wavelengths, and of course there is light, electromagnetic radiation at wavelengths far beyond red. It's called infrared, that we cannot see. I mean, our eyes are sensitive to the region that allows us to survive on the surface of Earth, and infrared is just not that helpful because, you know, there is not much infrared in sunlight, although our body emits in the infrared. But then there is also ultraviolet. If you go on the opposite side of the spectrum, very short wavelengths are ultraviolet, and if you make them even shorter, you get to X-rays and so forth. And astronomers are detecting all of these. Now, the same is true for gravitational waves. There are different wavelengths. So what LIGO detected are frequencies or wavelengths. Well, frequencies of kilohertz, that's 1,000 hertz or so, which corresponds to scales of order 100 kilometers. The wavelength that LIGO detected is of order 100 kilometers, and the reason is simple, somewhere between 10 and 100, because that's the characteristic size of black holes made of the cores of stars. So when stars collapse to make a black hole, they have typically several tens of solar masses, the mass of the sun, and the size of the horizon is tens of kilometers. So you end up with these wavelengths. When two black holes collide, they basically shake space-time and generate gravitational waves, which are just distortions of space-time, with that wavelength, the characteristic size of the black holes, of all the tens of kilometers. And if you take tens of kilometers and divide by the speed of light, you end up with a time scale of order a millisecond, one part in 1,000 of a second, and the inverse of that is the frequency of over a kilohertz. That's what LIGO is sensitive to, and for a good reason, because LIGO was intended to find gravitational waves from the collision of stellar mass black holes. Okay, so that's why. Now, when you deal with the Big Bang, basically the graviton background has roughly the same wavelengths as the cosmic microwave background photons. So we're talking about millimeter scale. And millimeter wavelength, in difference from 100 kilometers, you know, it's much, much shorter. So we're talking about, you know, tens of gigahertz or 100 gigahertz rather than a kilohertz. So that's very different frequency, about a billion times higher frequency or shorter wavelength than LIGO is sensitive to. So LIGO cannot see any gravitational waves with that very short wavelength. and because the arms of LIGO are just designed to detect very long wavelengths. So you need a completely different method to detect the graviton background. And one approach is, well, there are two ways to do that. One is to say, okay, let's just measure the energy density of radiation in the universe. So we have the microwave background, we have the neutrino background, and then we have the graviton background. So if we have a precise enough measurement of the content, the radiation content of the universe, which we can do in principle based on the expansion of the universe, then we can infer that there is a graviton background. That appears to be very challenging because the graviton background makes just a small fraction of the entire radiation background. It's mostly dominated by the microwave background. So that is a good approach. That's what I had in mind originally before we wrote the paper, and I suggested it to the postdoc, Tony Bagnuzzi, as the motivation. But it appears to be extremely challenging. And a better approach is to convert gravitons, those very high-frequency gravitational waves from the Big Bang, to convert them into an electromagnetic signal, which can be done if you have a strong enough magnetic field. So the idea is in the laboratory, you produce a setup with a very strong magnetic field, and you can show that it's possible to convert a graviton into an electromagnetic wave in such a strong magnetic field. There is a physical process that allows you to convert a graviton to a photon. And that is the approach that at least some experimentalists suggested that it's potentially feasible. So we checked the numbers, and in principle, it's possible to do that if there is enough funding for such an experiment.
How strong a magnetic field do you need, and do we have the technology now, or is that way off in the future?
No, we do have the technology. It's just a question of funding, and it's also you have to realize that cosmic inflation was pretty much the most popular paradigm in cosmology for several decades. So what needs to happen is that someone would say, okay, well, we should test it. And that is not common in the scientific community. When an idea becomes popular, people don't want to refute it. They actually subscribe to it because there are lots of people that dedicated decades to explore this idea. So there would be resistance, reluctance to even test it. On the other hand, you know, the funding agencies would be glad to spend, $1 billion in testing, you know, proving that cosmic inflation took place. And there are such proposals on the table of the National Science Foundation or NASA. So I would say it just in terms of scientific politics, it's more likely that proposals to prove inflation will be funded much more heavily than proposals to refute it. And I would think that even 1% or 10% of the funds that will be allocated to prove inflation, if they were dedicated to such an experiment, it can be done. So it's just a question of the will of the scientific community to entertain the possibility that the popular idea might be wrong. And I should say here there is actually a precedence for that, because the Large Hadron Collider was funded at $10 billion to demonstrate that supersymmetry exists. And that's in addition to discovering the Higgs boson, which was relatively old news. They looked for supersymmetry and didn't find it. So here is an example for a $10 billion project that ended up, ruling out the natural parameter space for supersymmetries. So things that were very popular within the scientific community ended up being falsified. And I would argue that that's the way to make progress in science. You can't just based on popularity decide that it's not worth checking something, because very often, you know, what we believe in doesn't happen to be the case. Just to give you an example, between 1935 and 1939, in the span of 4 years, 2 years after he came to the Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton, Albert Einstein made three major mistakes. He wrote three papers, one saying quantum mechanics doesn't have entanglement, doesn't have spooky action at a distance, as he argued. Black holes don't exist. And a third paper on the fact that gravitation waves don't exist. So he wrote these three papers immediately as he came to Princeton, and he was celebrated. He was in the most, in the prime of his career. Okay, made these three mistakes. And over the past 5 years, between 2017 and 2022, this year, three Nobel Prizes in physics were awarded to the people who demonstrated that Einstein was wrong. First was the gravitational wave detection by LIGO. Second was the demonstration that black holes exist by discovering the black hole at the center of the Milky Way. And the third was this year, the experimental discovery of entanglement in the laboratory, showing that Einstein was wrong three times. So three Nobel Prizes just over the past 5 years for three mistakes that Einstein made between 1935 and 1939 at the prime of his career. And what does it show us? It shows us, you know, that very often we are wrong. That when you work at the frontiers, there is a lot of risk because, you know, nature or reality represents just one possibility out of many. And it's not necessarily the possibility that we would favor. Einstein favored other possibilities, and he was wrong. So it's only by experiments that we can learn. It's a learning experience. And science brings humility because you can't just make it a monologue where you tell nature what it's supposed to be and then don't even check it. And I find it, you know, that nowadays in academia, that's not necessarily the attitude being taken, because you have in theoretical physics, there is a paradigm, for example, of string theory that existed for 50 years, not tested, doesn't even make a prediction that can be tested in the foreseeable future. And yet you have hundreds of prominent theoretical physicists working on it, celebrating it, giving each other awards, honors, speaking about it on television, radio, everywhere, as if that's the frontier of science. But there is no proof, no evidence to support it. And besides, it's not even making a prediction that can be testable. And besides, the people who practiced it for five decades do not even feel an obligation to confirm it by experiment. And besides, just a week ago, there was a computer simulation on a quantum computer that got a lot of publicity of a model of string theory that is not even representing the reality that we live in, but represents some dual to the reality we live in, and is an oversimplified model of string theory that is not even claimed to be representative of the dual to the reality that we live in which they noticed something to do with wormholes. And that got publicity as if they did an experiment. It's not an experiment. It's not even real. It's not even representing the reality that we live in. And yet, they live in this virtual reality. And it's no different than putting goggles on our head and living in the metaverse and looking like Brad Pitt all the time. You know, like, you can live in a reality that you believe in, but that's not physics. That could be mathematics. You can show that you are smart, but that's not really the point. The point is to understand reality. And if you can't make mistakes, if it's not possible to prove that you are wrong, then the physics Nobel Prize will never be awarded to whatever you're talking about. So irrespective of whether you are right or wrong, it has to be testable in order for it to be part of physics. And that's what I'm saying is sort of obvious, but it doesn't seem to be popular within the mainstream of academia. I'm not talking about a fringe group of people in theoretical physics that were working on it on the sidelines. I'm talking about the mainstream, the main component of theoretical physics that for five decades, 50 years, has been discussing this subject and doesn't even feel the need to consider experimental tests and beyond that, celebrate its accomplishment without any guilt feelings that they don't test their ideas. So something is wrong in the way that, and then, you know, obviously in academia, there is a lot of complaints about politicians that don't pay attention to evidence and promote ideas that are not necessarily reflecting reality. Well, how can we complain if the scientific community is behaving this way?
John, do you have anything else?
I do. I don't want to take up too much more time, but in your paper, Avi, you talk about alternatives to inflation. You already mentioned the bouncing cosmologies. Can you talk about the emergent scenarios? What are those?
You mean emergent in the context of quantum mechanics or in the context of the early cosmology?
The early cosmology.
The popular culture of people who work on early cosmology is that that in fact quantum fluctuations allow you to have many different realizations of what we see in our universe that are quite different from each other, and everything that can happen will happen an infinite number of times. And then the only reason that we find the conditions that we find in the present-day universe is because they allow us to exist. That's called the anthropic argument. And so, in principle, everything is possible. So if we find something, some property of our universe, there is a model of inflation that would accommodate that. I find that not very satisfactory, because then it's sort of like tautology. I mean, you cannot prove it wrong, because anything you find can in principle exist. So it gives sort of a comfort, a zone for all these people who work on this, including string theories. But it's a psychological comfort that is delusional, because, you know, it cannot be falsified. So we are not doing physics. It's sort of like the belief system of philosophies or religions, but the way science was conceived, at least, you know, the way that I was educated, is that if you want to describe reality, you must make a statement that could be tested, because otherwise we don't know whether it applies to reality, you know. I mean, obviously we can feel good about ourselves, you know, by showing off that we are smart, by doing mathematical manipulations. But, and you can always dedicate your career to the question of how many angels can dance on the head of a pin. But the question is, do angels really exist? I mean, you can show that you are smart, do it in extra dimensions, but it's really a test. The testable predictions are the most important, and they might not require mathematical sophistication. So instead of focusing about showing off and demonstrating that we are smart, we should focus on what is correct, you know, what's describing reality. And there is a very good reason for that, because once we understand reality, we can adapt to it. Once we understand what the virus of COVID-19 is, we can develop mRNA vaccines. Once we understand that we are moving around the sun and not the sun is moving around the earth, then we can design space missions that allow us to reach Mars. And if we don't verify, if we think that the earth is at the center of the world, then we think that Mars moves around the earth, we would never reach the destination with a space mission. So it's really important to follow the scientific method. That is my current, you know, how should I say, frustration with the way that some parts of physics are taken.
I know we have other topics to talk about, but I've seen articles where many people think that the James Webb Telescope is providing information contrary to the Big Bang. Do you know anything about that? Is there any?
Yeah, no, that's completely completely inappropriate interpretation of the data that we have. I should say that I was a member of the scientific advisory board that designed the Webb Telescope in the mid-1990s, and that's because I was among the first people to work on the first stars and galaxies in the universe. I wrote two textbooks about that, and the main goal of the Webb Telescope was to explore the earliest galaxies. And indeed, the deepest images from the Webb Telescope allow us to do that. So, I mean, the first deep images were celebrated at the White House by President Biden and Vice President Harris on July 11, 2022. And we now have measurements. Actually, just an hour ago, I saw a new press release from NASA that talks about an identification of two galaxies that existed when the universe was just 300 million years old, you know, just 300 million years after the Big Bang. The very first galaxies are expected to have formed about 100 million years after the Big Bang. That's just 1% of the present age of the universe. That's when the first stars formed. And that's sort of our cosmic roots. And it's sort of the like exploring the scientific version of the story of Genesis. And now what we learn is that galaxies formed very early, which is just what we expected, but the properties of the stars might be different than the stars we see today. In fact, the theoretical calculations that I was part of predicted that the first stars were more massive than the stars we have today, and they were given the name as Population 3 stars, a very unusual population of massive stars. That and the reason for that is that the cosmic gas early on didn't have heavy elements. It had primarily hydrogen and helium left over from the Big Bang. So you end up making large stars because the gas cannot cool very effectively and fragment into small pieces. And indeed, it's possible that the Webb telescope is providing the first evidence for that early population of massive stars because we see much more ultraviolet light coming from those galaxies than we would have anticipated. And so some people say, oh, yeah, there are very big galaxies early on that contradicts the Big Bang. Well, first of all, even if there were much more massive galaxies, much more luminous galaxies early on, it would say nothing about the Big Bang. It just says something about galaxy formation, you know, how early do galaxies form and how big they are. But putting that aside, most likely is that if indeed there is a lot of ultraviolet light emitted by the early galaxies hundreds of millions of years after the Big Bang, that may well be because the first stars were much more massive, they were hotter, and they emitted much more ultraviolet light. And that appears to explain the existing data. So there's nothing in conflict with the Big Bang.
Okay, and listeners, we have some other topics to talk about with Professor Loeb, but Avi, you do have another caller on hold, so let's quickly go to the other caller, and then we'll move on to some of the other things you want to talk about. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you? Where are you, please?
This is John in Fort Worth. I just want to ask you a question. What's your view on the subject of, you know, it looks like most all the evidence recently shows that we're in a very flat universe, you know, and yet, at least my limited understanding of relativity and cosmological solutions would say that if you move back in time toward the Big Bang, if it's flat, it remains flat, and so it's basically infinite all the way back. Unless it's and so I don't see how do we get around that problem, or is there some other way that we've analyzed it since what I've seen that's got around that issue.
That's an excellent question, and that's one of the issues that cosmic inflation intended to resolve, because as you say, if the universe is nearly flat today, it should have been even closer to being flat as you go back in time. And basically, it's a fine-tuning problem that if you want to end up with a universe that is close to being flat today, it had to be extremely flat. The geometry had to be extremely fine-tuned to be almost exactly flat early on. And the question is, what process can do that? And in the case of cosmic inflation, and here I'm giving a reason for why people suggested it in the first place, what ends up happening is there is this period of a vast expansion, accelerated expansion of space. So just think of it as an iron. If you have deviations from flatness, like, for example, suppose there are small ripples in space-time, then as you stretch them out as a result of the cosmic expansion during inflation, you can actually flatten them. And basically, if you start with a little bit of deviation or any deviation from flatness, cosmic inflation is making it flat. That was one of the motivations for supporting the model of inflation, that it could lead to a flat universe of the type that we observe today. So this is one way of doing it. And of course, another possibility is that the initial conditions of the universe were perfectly flat for some reason, that our region of space-time happened to be that way. And some physicists may argue, well, it was needed in order to allow us to exist. If the universe was not flat, perhaps it would have collapsed long ago, and galaxies like the Milky Way would not have existed. We wouldn't exist. All of that is a matter of speculation. But there are mechanisms, either, you know, if you fine-tune the initial conditions that way, because it would allow galaxies like the Milky Way to exist, or if you have cosmic inflation, you can end up in the present-day flatness.
Okay, that makes sense, I guess. Well, one last thing, I know we don't have much time, as I understand what she was saying, but your theory that you're putting out now is that there's a gravitational wave creation before the inflation period that you're proposing we could detect, right? If I get that right.
Yeah, so cosmic inflation was expected to happen when the universe had temperatures that are a few orders of magnitude smaller than the maximum temperature that one can imagine, which is called the Planck temperature. That's when gravity is unified with everything else. That's when quantum gravity comes into play. So the highest temperature that you can imagine, given the theory we have of quantum mechanics, that's when gravity is as important as all the other forces. That's called the Planck temperature. At that point, you know, if you go back all the way to that temperature, then you would expect gravitons to be produced by collisions of particles, and they would be as prominent as photons, as the radiation, because everything is sort of unified on the same footing. So you would produce as much energy density in this graviton background at similar frequencies as the radiation that we see in the cosmic microwave background today. So that's the idea. Now, inflation, if it takes place afterwards, which is really what all of the models of inflation talk about, then it would basically expand space by a vast amount, such that if there was a graviton background, it would be diluted completely. There would be nothing left from it after inflation. Now, the radiation, the electromagnetic radiation, the cosmic microwave background, is expected to be generated afterwards when the energy density of inflation decays. The vacuum decays. It decays into radiation. It doesn't decay into a graviton background because the temperature is much smaller. So you end up making electromagnetic waves, but not gravitational waves of the same energy density, simply because the temperature is much smaller than the Planck temperature at that time. And so that's a generic outcome of inflation, that it occurs after the Planck time, and as a result, it dilutes everything that was produced at the Planck time, and it doesn't regenerate a graviton background. It does regenerate a cosmic microwave background.
Okay, well, I think I understand that then. I guess David wants to go on his other topics, right?
So we don't have an abundance of time. So, but if it's slow and you want to call back in, call in, okay?
Okay.
Thank you. Avi, are there any updates on your Galileo project?
A lot is happening. So the Galileo project, just to remind everyone, it started about a year and a few months ago when a few multi-billionaires came to the porch of my home, and they were inspired by my book, Extraterrestrial, and gave me a few million dollars without me doing any fundraising. And then I established this project that aims to study unusual objects near Earth that may have originated from an advanced technological civilization somewhere else. And we are moving along three fronts. One is to explore interstellar objects, objects that enter the solar system from outside, like the one that was reported in 2017 by a telescope in Hawaii called the Oumuamua that looked very weird, didn't look like any of the rocks that are familiar to us from the solar system, wasn't a comet, wasn't an asteroid. And I wrote about it in my book, Extraterrestrial. And so we plan a space mission that will rendezvous with the next Oumuamua, that will come close to it, take a high-resolution image of it so that we can tell what it is, because Oumuamua was very weird, unusual in its shape and properties. And that's one branch, but that is more for the future, once we identify more objects like Oumuamua. And then in the meantime, with my students, we discovered two meteors, roughly the size of a meter, that collided with Earth, one in 2014 and the second in March 2017, both of them before Oumuamua. And they were the first objects that were identified from outside the solar system before Oumuamua. And they were just moving much too fast to be bound to the sun. And we found them in a catalog of meteors compiled by the U.S. government. And since the discovery, the U.S. government confirmed one of them at the 99.999% confidence level that indeed it was interstellar in origin. It was not coming from the solar system, but from outside. And then we are planning, so both of them appear to be tougher than iron, tougher than all the space rocks that were discovered before. So the question is, what is it? It seems like interstellar objects originate from some other source, not from planetary systems like the solar system. There is less than a chance of less than one in 10,000 that they came from the distribution of material strength of solar system rocks. So they appear to be much tougher than all the meteors that we had seen before. And the question is, why would the first interstellar meteor be so different? And we are planning an expedition to scoop the ocean floor where the first meteor from 2014 disintegrated about 100 miles off the coast of Papua New Guinea. And I received funding at $1.5 million to do this expedition within the next 6 months. And what we want to do is collect the fragments and figure out their composition, what the object was made of, whether it was made of some unusual natural origin, perhaps iron or some other components, or was it a spacecraft, an artificial alloy such as stainless steel. So we will try to figure this out. Of course, it will be very exciting if we find that it's of artificial origin. I already promised the curator of the Museum of Modern Art in New York City that if we find a gadget, I'll bring it for display there because it would represent modernity for us, even though it's ancient history for whoever sent it. So that's the second branch of Galileo. And then the third branch of the project is looking at unidentified objects in the sky that the government talks about. These are the UAP, the Unidentified Aerial Phenomena. So we built a suite of instruments that are starting to collect data now. It's already working. And monitoring the sky 24/7. And we will use artificial intelligence algorithms to figure out the nature of these objects, and it will be a mixed bag. Most of them will belong to two categories. Either they're natural, like birds or insects, or they are human-made, like drones, planes, satellites, weather balloons, And if we find even one object which appears to not be natural because we see screws on the surface, and it doesn't appear to be human-made because it behaves in ways that human technology cannot reproduce, then it might have originated from somewhere else, and that would change the future of humanity. So we are open-minded to that possibility, and hopefully over the coming year we'll have much more data, and we plan to make it open to the public and publish it in peer-reviewed journals.
I know you have said a lot of other interesting things are happening. What else would you like to bring to our attention?
Well, I have a new book coming out that should come out on the 29th of August, 2023, and it's already on Amazon. And it discusses the implications for humanity of finding evidence for technological equipment from other civilizations. And there is also a documentary being in the planning on my first book. And so just a lot. And I should say that I provide steady updates on what's happening in my regular commentaries, essays that I post on Medium. So if you just Google Avi Loeb, A-V-I-L-O-E-B, Medium, you can see my latest update.
Are you looking at anything on physics that's really startling that you can tell us about? Any new or very different kind of research that might be happening or about to happen?
Yeah, so I can provide. There are new things happening all the time. So let me just mention one recent discovery. We know that there is a supermassive, a very massive black hole at the center of the Milky Way galaxy. The Nobel Prize was awarded for that a couple of years ago for the discovery of that black hole. 4 million times the mass of the sun. It's called Sagittarius A star. It's about 24,000 light years away from Earth at the center of the Milky Way. Now, we discovered over the past few months that with a postdoctoral fellow, Fabio Pacucci, that there is, in fact, a black hole of roughly the same mass at the outskirts of the Milky Way galaxy. Another one, not at the center of the Milky Way, but about a million light years away at the edge of the halo of the Milky Way galaxy, dwarf galaxy called the Leo 1. And we suggested that one can look for such a black hole in Leo 1 by trying to detect the emission from it as the gas is swirling towards it, just like as in the case of Sagittarius A star. And the gas that feeds it is originating from stars that are moving around it. And they have winds, and the winds are accreting onto that black hole. And we calculated how much emission would be expected and showed that existing instruments can detect it. And then we went ahead and assembled data from those instruments. And it seems like the data confirms the existence of a black 3 million times the mass of the sun, so not very different from the 4 million times the mass of the sun at the center of the Milky Way. Except this one, in Leo 1, the Leo 1 is a dwarf galaxy that is 1,000 times less massive than the Milky Way, so it seems like there is a giant black hole at its center. Even though the galaxy itself that hosts the black hole is 1,000 times less massive than the Milky Way. And the question is, how is that possible? And one simple explanation is that the Leo 1 in the past came very close to the center of the Milky Way, and the outer envelope of that galaxy was ripped apart. So it used to be much more massive, but by now it's only the core of that galaxy that survived. with the Black Quality Center. So anyway, that's exciting because now we found a second black hole roughly of the same mass in our vicinity. So that's the second supermassive black hole nearby, and it's much farther away than the galactic center, but nevertheless, it's exciting.
You have another caller who's waiting on hold. Let's take the caller. Hi, caller. Welcome to the program. Who are you and where are you, please?
Hi, this is Amir from Israel.
Hi, Amir. Welcome to the show. How are you doing?
I'm doing all right. Avi, you mentioned the project to chase an interstellar object. Can you say more about the status of the project, how far the engineering is going, how far the financing is going?
Right. So that is a very expensive project in the sense that it's a space mission. So it will cost more than $1 billion to rendezvous with an object like Oumuamua. And first, we need to identify such an object, and we have a dating app, meaning there would be a telescope that will send us candidates for us to date with and to rendezvous with. And that is the Vera Rubin Observatory in Chile that will start operations in about a year, and then will be much more sensitive than the Pan-STARRS telescope in Hawaii that discovered Oumuamua. So we expect more objects like Oumuamua to be provided by this survey telescope, the Vera Rubin Observatory. And then we hope to then go through the list of interstellar objects that it finds. And then most of the time we will swipe to the left, basically decide not to rendezvous with an object, not to go on a date, because the date is very expensive. And then we hopefully will find one that looks as unusual as Oumuamua, and then send the space mission. And so we conducted the study of what the space mission should be about, and we also got a quarter of $1 million to from the Southwest Research Institute to perform the study. But the cost of $1 billion will require that such a project has to be funded by a space agency, just like NASA or ESA. And so hopefully within a year, we hope to propose it. Now, ESA, the European Space Agency, has already a project that they call Comet Interceptor, which is basically to come close to a comet. First, I should say that Oumuamua was not a comet. There was no cometary evaporation from it. But more importantly, an interstellar object is expected to move through the solar system at the speed of tens of kilometers per second, or for the at least 30 or 40 kilometers per second. And unfortunately, this comet interceptor that ESA is planning would be able to maneuver only at a level of a few kilometers per second. It will not have enough propulsion to go faster than that. So it will be very difficult if one identifies an interstellar object, very difficult to come close to it because the object would move much faster than the interceptor. So it's sort of like going to a highway and seeing cars speeding by, and if you want to get close to them and you're moving at the speed of an ant, you would never make it. So as much as the ESA project sounds appealing in terms of the keywords, it's just that the maneuvering ability of what they have in mind is not good enough. And so we hope that, you know, there will be a proposal to NASA within a year, so we will see what happens with that.
How long before a possible rendezvous do you expect to be able to detect an interstellar object? But do you have the time to plan?
We expect, given the sensitivity of the Vera Rubin Observatory, we expect that at least a few objects like Oumuamua to be discovered every year, assuming that they come into the solar system at random. Of course, if Oumuamua was artificial, a probe that was sent, that was directed into the habitable zone, of the solar system. We can't really tell how frequently such probes are arriving, but if you just assume that it was not an unusual occurrence, that such things happen all the time, then there should be, every few years, at least one of those objects within the orbit of the Earth around the Sun. So given the sensitivity of the Vera Rubin Observatory, then we should find a few every year. That would allow us a lot of opportunities, in principle, to catch them as they approach the Earth, before they arrive close to Earth. So we don't need to chase them afterwards, but we can meet them halfway.
So, but you would need to detect them quite a long time before they reach the solar system or the center of the solar system.
That's right. And, you know, with the speed of Oumuamua, it was moving at a speed where, in principle, with the Vera Rubin Observatory, we could see it a year in advance. So that will give us enough time. If we have a system ready, and we know about it a year in advance, it gives enough time to meet it halfway. As long as you propel the, you have maneuvered, you can also park such a mission already in space and just give it the appropriate boost so that it meets the interstellar object in time. So all of this has to be assembled, it would be best to put it in space to start with.
Mm-hmm. So that has to be ready before the detection. The system needs to be ready before the detection. So
definitely.
You do need to fund quite a lot of it before the detection.
Yeah, and I should say it's very different than all the space missions that were funded before, because if you look at the history of space missions by NASA, for example, it was always targeting a specific object. The target was known in advance, and then you design the space mission so that you will meet the target. Here, you don't know the target in advance, so it will have to be a completely new breed of space mission where you just wait for the opportunity to arrive, and then you go there. So it's a different design, and it was never attempted before. I hope that it will be received favorably by the space agencies.
It does have a common characteristic with the planetary protection, where you build something and then you wait for the need to use it.
Right. Except the planetary protection depends which method you're using to protect the Earth. And most recently, there was the DART mission by NASA, where it was the brute force approach of just colliding with an object to deflect it. Okay, that was the DART mission. If you think about other methods of deflecting an object, you can, in principle, shine a laser on the surface of the object and evaporate it so that it gets a kick from the rocket effect. You could also paint an object so that it reflects more sunlight. There are various ways of deflecting the trajectory of an object. So depending on which method you're using, it will dictate, where you need to put your system in advance.
Right. But in any case, you do need to have a technology ready in advance. Whether it's a laser or a painting or whatever.
That's right. So this is indeed a new category of space missions that was never attempted, because in the past it was always, the target was always identified before the funding was allocated.
Okay, very good. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Amir. Good to hear from you. Avi, I have a note from John in Fort Worth, Texas. Could the massive black hole that the nearby small galaxy be the remnant of a quasar? The active state from years ago would have died down by now.
Oh, yeah. Any massive black hole that we see grew by the accretion of dust. And dust or gas. During the growth of the black hole, you have an episode of a lot of inflow of gas that shines very brightly that we call quasar. And often it outshines the the host galaxy is 100 times brighter than the combined light from all the stars in the galaxy. So indeed, any such black hole was in a quasar phase to start with. Now, I should say that the few million solar mass black holes are really at the lower end of the spectrum of masses of black holes. That the biggest black holes we know in the universe go all the way up to 10 billion times the mass of the sun, 10 to the power 10. So it's about a factor of a few thousand above the mass of Sagittarius A star, or this one in Leo 1. So we are talking here about very low mass black holes relative to what the universe makes. And in fact, the biggest black holes of billions of solar masses, they were made in, we see them all the way back to when the first galaxies formed. Like if we go back to when the universe was less than a billion years old, we see such quasars that are very bright that correspond to black holes of billions of solar masses. And the question is why, how can the delivery room of the early universe include such giant babies? You know, like why, how could the giant black holes be made so early? As it turns out, billions of solar masses represent the upper envelope of black holes all the way from the beginning to the present time. It's not as if we find today black holes that are much more massive than 10 billion solar masses. So somehow there is a cap to the black hole masses at around 10 billion times the mass of the sun. And it seems to be universal all the way from the beginning. And the question is, how do you make such massive black holes so early in the delivery of the universe? And that's still an open question.
You have another caller on hold. I think you have time, and this will probably be the last call. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you? Where are you, please?
Hi, it's Tony Cook. And I have a question for Dr. Loeb. One of David's guests on quite often is a doctor. Is it John Brandenburg? He feels that he has evidence for some kind of, high civilization in space because of an abundance of, I believe it's xenon on Mars, a certain isotope that isn't found commonly in the solar system except at the site of nuclear explosions. And I have kind of two questions about that. First of all, is it possible that an extraterrestrial or an extrasolar meteorite could deliver abundances of isotopes that don't exist in the solar system so that you don't have to posit a nuclear war on Mars to get that xenon there? And what do you think of the whole theory? Or hypothesis, I should say.
So when dealing with element abundances, we don't really know what kind of stellar explosions occurred close to the solar system in the past. And it may well be that xenon happened to be delivered to the surface of Mars by, objects like interstellar objects from the vicinity of the solar system or from far away that enriched it in ways that you don't see elsewhere. And it's not an indication for anything artificial. If you see, for example, if you find a gadget, obviously it has to be artificial. If you find some direct evidence that it was planted, then it's artificial. But just finding an element of a different abundance in one particular location does not argue for an artificial origin, because you could have delivered it by a natural object that came from far away, such as the interstellar objects I was talking about. There could be some population of rocks that come from very distant stars, and perhaps those stars were much more enriched than xenon for one reason or another, and then they land on Mars, and that's what you find. So in order to argue for an artificial origin, for a visit by some technological civilization, then you need more than that, more than abundances. That's not sufficient evidence.
Okay. And so now I guess his argument was that at least it's sort of testable because you could go to Mars and then look for evidence of the war hypothesis, right?
Which hypothesis?
Which I would agree. I don't think that's the likely outcome, but at least his idea would be testable in that sense, I suppose.
Yeah, but I wouldn't go that path until there is another piece of evidence that argues for an artificial origin. So just that is not sufficient, one element. In the context of the expedition I was talking about, the idea is to collect enough fragments from the meteor so that we can actually, it's not just one element, we will be able to tell what all the elements that made up this object were. And obviously, one can tell the difference between a rock made of even iron or just a stone and an artificial spacecraft. I mean, we can tell the difference between stainless steel and a rock. So that, if you detect stainless steel somewhere, then you can argue that that is artificial.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Tony.
Hoping to hear. Thanks. All right. You're welcome.
Avi, I know you need to run. Is there anything we should have talked about or that you want to share with us in the remaining couple of minutes?
There are lots of exciting developments, but I think we covered the most interesting ones. And just stay tuned. We will have this expedition within 6 months, and I look forward to seeing what we might find, and also with the Galileo project, observing the sky and collecting data on unusual objects. Let's allow nature to guide us rather than prejudice or the number of likes on social media. I think this is really the way that we can make discoveries, and hopefully, you know, I think that science is exciting. It shouldn't be boring. It shouldn't be about experts arguing that they know everything in advance. It should be more about the childhood curiosity where, you know, we collect evidence and let nature educate us about what's out there. And I mean, there is this pretension by experts that most of the stuff is already known, but I would argue that our scientific knowledge is just an island in an ocean of ignorance. So there is a lot to be found, and a lot of it could be very exciting.
You got an email just now. Do you have time for a short email?
Okay, go ahead.
Paul is in Boston, and he says, Avi, when you were talking earlier about science and you just summed it up in a couple of minutes ago, it made me think of our discussion going on regarding climate change. It seems that the people that are talking about it have already made up their minds. They're not open to new ideas, and you can't get any inputs into them. Do you see any similarities into some of the problems you talked about with space science earlier in the show and the climate change discussions going on, even with scientists?
Yeah, of course, in many disciplines, including climate change, especially climate change, because it has political aspects to it. There is a dogma that dominates, and people just, you know, subscribe to the groupthink and are not thinking critically about the problem. But I would argue that we should, irrespective of what the interpretation of the warming of the climate is, we should always aim to do the right thing. Like, if we realize that it's better for our health to have less pollution, we should avoid pollution just because it's not good for our health. So I think instead of arguing what is the reason, let's just do what seems to be right and better for the humans in the long term. And so, yes, I would say that it's very common to see these dogmas dominating the discussion, and it's quite unfortunate. Another place where you could have seen it recently was when COVID-19 broke out. There were two competing interpretations of where it came from. One was the natural origin and from some animal, but that was never traced. And the second was the Wuhan laboratory. And because of the politics behind, there was a complete dismissal of the lab hypothesis from any discussion. And once again, it was not the right thing to do because, you know, we want to understand the origin irrespective of politics so that we can prevent it in the future. So it's not a political issue. It's more how to avoid it from happening in the future and moderate the risk from something like COVID-19. And unfortunately, the scientific community was not open to such a discussion because of the political implications, just like in the case of climate change. And you see it over and over again. I think we would be better off if people were more open-minded to different sides of the argument so that we can get to the truth. And, you know, even if COVID-19 originated from a natural origin, it's better to show the evidence, to find what caused it. And by arguing that it's definitely not from a lab, you are not allowing the discussion to explore data and figure out the truth. And that's not good.
Avi, I want to thank you very much for joining us again. Wish you the best for the holiday season and New Year's, and we'll look forward to talking to you about some of these things in your book and these timelines and projects in 2023.
Thanks for inviting me.
Thank you again. Listeners, that's it for today, and we appreciate Dr. Avi Loeb coming with us. Remember, please, that if you like these kind of programs and these truly open discussions, they're not dogma, I can assure you, not with Dr. Loeb, do support the Space Show as we are in our annual campaign, and we're listener-supported, and we do need the support. I also do want to thank our sponsors. I didn't do that up front because I wanted more time with Dr. Loeb, but we thank Northrop Grumman, Space Foundation, Astrox, AIAA, Celestis, the National Space Society, and Dr. Ben Arroyo with his Lunar Habitat and Lunar Development books. He's more of a billboard sponsor for us. And if you want to be a sponsor or a billboard advertiser, please reach out to me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. We'll be back on Sunday with Open Lines. Do support the Space Show. I keep saying that over and over again. Our campaign is limited. It ends December 31st because we are a nonprofit. And for people wanting tax deductions, we need to receive their gift in 2022, or at least needs to be postmarked by 2022. Everybody have a great weekend coming up, and stay safe, stay healthy. Keep looking up. And for archive listeners, if you want to comment to Dr. Loeb, post it on the blog. I make sure that our guests see the commentary on the blog, and it's up to them whether they want to respond to it. He also has a faculty page at Harvard in the physics department, astrophysics department. It's easy to find his email address. And I've always found that he responds very rapidly. He's a really nice guy. Once again, keep looking up. Goodbye from Avi Loeb, David, and the Space Show.